5 weeks ago, we started talking about evil. And the word, does anybody remember what the word is for evil in Hebrew?
Ra.
Ra. Very good. That's a fun one to learn. One of the things that I have been trying to communicate, and maybe this has landed, maybe it hasn't, is that Ra is not just about moral compromise. Evil is not just moral compromise. Ra can refer to calamity, trouble, disaster. Ra is essentially anti-creation, anti-life, anti-flourishing. Anything that's taking away from the flourishing of creation, away from life, is considered Ra. And so the question that we've been looking at for the last 2 weeks is not going to come up on the screen. Does anybody wants to go just push? All you have to do is push it once and then that'll kick my clicker on. But I already know the question is, what is God doing about evil? Isn't that right? What is God doing about evil? And we looked at creation. What is God doing about evil in the first 2-3 chapters of the Bible? And then last week we looked at what is God doing about evil in the rest of the Old Testament. The topic of what God is doing about evil is a really broad topic, and we could have just camped out in the Old Testament really like forever and talked about what God is doing. But I tried to draw our attention to 4 basic themes. In the Old Testament, God is beginning a new creation in the midst of the first creation. Thank you, Kelly. God doesn't abandon his creation to decay and eventually destruction after the initial sin in the garden. Instead, he begins this project of making a new creation. So he selects Noah, and you have man and you have animals. You have eventually the waters part and dry land appears. And we talked about all of this last week, just to remind you. He initiates this new world with new gardens and new atoms. And it reminds me of like trying to crank a lawnmower. I have a push mower for the front yard that won't turn over. I can't get it to turn over. And it reminds me of just, it's like God is trying to start a new creation. And start a new creation. How about Noah? How about Abraham? How about Moses? And it's like he can't get it to turn over until Jesus, of course, and we're going to talk about that today. He teaches humans to discern good and evil the way that he does, because humans are tasked with ordering creation the way that God has. They're going to be his covenant partners, but that's going to require wisdom to discern what's good and what's evil. So he makes us with the moral capacity to know what's good and what's evil. Problem is, we decide for ourselves. And so one of the things God does in the Old Testament is teaches us what's good and what's raw, according to his definition. And then he tests would-be snake crushers. There are several figures in the Old Testament who are candidates, that maybe they will be the ones who are going to crush the head of the snake that is promised in Genesis 3. And eventually he banishes Israel when they prove to be corrupt. The same way he banished Adam and Eve, he banishes Israel into exile. And so sitting in exile, the people may be wondering if there is any hope for creation at all. Which led to our last little bit last week, which is that hope is going to be rooted in God's faithfulness, but it also needs to be rooted in human obedience. There is hope, not that humans have been awesome, but that God has consistently been committed to creation. Every time humans have messed up, God has proven that he's faithful. And so our hope is rooted in the fact that God is going to continue to be faithful. At the same time, God has already determined that he is going to use humans to bring order to creation. He's already promised it's going to be a human who crushes the snake. And so human obedience has to play some sort of role in the eradication of Ra. So we come to the end of the Old Testament waiting for this human who's going to be obedient where all others have failed, and who's going to trust where all others have distrusted, and who is going to rule all things. Which brings us to the New Testament and the distinctive claims about Jesus in the New Testament. So any questions on that before we dig into the new stuff this week?
I've got a question, which I'm sorry because I haven't been here, but he tests would-be snake crushers. Who are some of the ones he tested?
The example that first comes to mind is King Saul. Saul is anointed. He's going to be the representative of Israel, who is the representative, he's like the new Adam. And he is tested whether he's going to trust God or not. Will he be patient, wait for Samuel or not? And he decides to do what is right in his own eyes. And as a result, the kingdom is taken away. Or really, I should have talked about how Israel goes into the wilderness and Israel is supposed to be the snake crusher. But they grumble and complain and distrust. All right. The 27 books of the New Testament are written after the death and resurrection of Jesus. And they're all written for believers and church communities. And these 27 books are about who this Jesus is and what he did and what he is now doing and why he matters and what the Jesus event means for us and how he fits into the whole flow of the story. That is, you have 39 books in the Old Testament, and then you have an event, an historical event of the person of Jesus. And then you have 27 books that are written in light of the event, connecting the dots between what came before and who Jesus is and why he matters. And one of the distinctive claims about Jesus is that he is the one who came to crush the snake in Genesis 3. So how is that? A few thoughts. First of all, Jesus is Israel's representative. And Israel is meant to be Adam 2.0. Remember, Adam and Eve are created to subdue creation, to rule. They have a kingly sort of role. They have a priestly sort of role. And then they squander it. And Israel is called to be this new kingdom of priests. They're to take on the role that Adam and Eve had in creation. They're going to mediate God's blessing to all of creation. But they fail at that. And so Jesus takes on the story of Israel, and he becomes what Israel was supposed to be. Does that make sense? A few ways that he does this. And I think Matthew's story is probably the one that draws this out the clearest. So if you have a Bible and want to follow, you can. I'm not turning to Matthew, but the story of Matthew begins with the birth of Jesus. Well, it begins with the genealogy, but you have the birth of Jesus, and then Joseph has a dream. His father has a dream telling him that he needs to go to Egypt. Why does he need to go to Egypt? Anybody remember? Because the king is killing all the baby boys in Bethlehem. And so you have the murder of a bunch of innocent children. Are there any other stories where a tyrant king murders a bunch of babies?
Moses.
Yeah, it's the story of the Exodus. Right? So here's Jesus, who is in Egypt, and surrounding that, it's not a perfect parallel, but surrounding that is this sort of new Pharaoh-like character in Herod. And then Jesus, when he's old enough, leaves Egypt. And Matthew says, this is to fulfill what was spoken, out of Egypt I called my son. Oh, well, if you go back and read, I think it's Hosea, that's about Israel. But now Matthew is saying that's about Jesus, because Jesus is Israel. The next thing that happens is Jesus' baptism. He passes through water. What's the next thing that Israel does after they leave Egypt? They pass through the water. And then once they're on the other side of the water, what do they spend 40 years doing? They're not wandering through the wilderness because they're being led. What are they being led by? God, Spirit, or the pillar of cloud and fire. And Nehemiah explicitly says that the pillar of cloud and fire is the Spirit of God. So they're being led by the Spirit. Well, Jesus is being led by the Spirit through the wilderness. I think in Matthew's gospel it says he's led by the Spirit into the wilderness, but in Luke's gospel it says he's being led through the wilderness. And while he's out in the wilderness, what's happening to him? He's being tested, right? He's being tested three different times. And all three times, how does Jesus respond? Do we remember the story? Sorry? With the word of God. He responds with the word of God. And more specifically, he responds with Deuteronomy. And even more specifically, he responds with the parts of Deuteronomy that are remembering the story of Israel in the wilderness. And he says, man doesn't live by bread alone, thinking about the story of manna and the other two. But he's tested by the serpent, and Jesus passes the test. Israel did not pass the test, but Jesus does. And so when he comes out of the wilderness, you actually have two different versions of what happens, like what his first order of business is. And so I don't know if I'm making too much of this. In Luke's gospel, when he emerges from the wilderness, the very first thing he does is he goes to the synagogue and he unrolls the scroll of Isaiah where it is written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me," to proclaim good news. So this is now his mission. Like, he's passed the test and now he's going to go and proclaim good news and freedom for the captive and all that, sight for the blind. In Matthew's gospel, the first thing he does after he comes out of the wilderness is he appoints deputies, disciples. He starts gathering some people to follow him, and they're going to learn from him how to do what he does. And again, I don't know if I'm making too much of this, but in the wilderness, in Exodus 18, Moses is getting all run down because of these people that he's trying to lead, and his father-in-law tells him he needs to appoint some deputies. He needs some help. And so they get all these chieftains and elders that are going to act as judges. And if they can't handle a case, then they'll bring it to Moses. And once Jesus has emerged from the wilderness and he's appointed his deputies and the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, then he goes up onto a mountain. Does that sound familiar? It's the story of Israel. This is like a new Mount Sinai. And he gives a sermon where he says six times, "You have heard that it was said," and he quotes from Sinai, "but I say to you," and then he gets to the heart of the issue. So Jesus is here to do what Israel was meant to do. He is the Adam 2.0. And actually, Paul will call him a new Adam. Okay. Another part of how Jesus is the snake crusher. Jesus has come to plunder the strong man's house. This is in Mark 3, if you wanted to just see it in front of you. Mark has the most to say, by the way, about Jesus' ministry of casting out demons, which if we had added like demonic power to this whole study of evil, it would have just grown exponentially. So we haven't focused much on demons for good reason. But Mark frames Jesus' ministry in terms of spiritual warfare. In Mark's gospel, Jesus is baptized and he goes into the wilderness, and then he comes back and he goes into the synagogue and he starts teaching, and there's a man there who stands up and says, "I know who you are, you're the Holy One of God." And Jesus says, "Zip it," and he casts the demon out of the man. Jesus' first order of business is to start kicking some demon tail. And he's going to do it over and over and over. In chapter 3, he's been doing so many crazy things. He's been letting his guys pick grain on the Sabbath. And he's been talking to demons. And he's been healing people and forgiving sins. And people just say, this is nuts. He must be working in the power of the demonic. And Jesus says in chapter 3, well, that's ridiculous. Because if Satan fights against Satan, How can he stand? A house divided against itself can't stand. Instead, if you want to plunder a strong man's house, I got to read this because the wording is perfect. In chapter 3, verse 27, he says, "No one can enter a strong man's house and plunder his goods unless he first binds the strong man. Then indeed he may plunder his house." What is Jesus here to do? He's here to bind the strong man and plunder his house. Now, does anybody have your Bible open to chapter 3?
Yes.
Turn it to chapter 5. Chapter 5, just a chapter and a half later, we meet this man who is possessed by a horde of demons, a legion of demons. And the text explicitly says, in chapter 5, let's see, it's verse 3, he lived among the tombs and no one could bind him, not even with a chain. For he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Ah, what we need is someone who can bind the strong man. And Jesus does bind him, but not with cords and not with chains. He binds him by freeing the man from his demonic oppression. Are you tracking with me? Jesus comes to bind the strong man. Part of what it means for Jesus to be the snake crusher is that he has defeated spiritual powers. Another part of what it means for Jesus to be the snake crusher. Should I stop? Do we have questions? I feel like I've been talking forever. Okay, we'll wait until the end of the slide. So Jesus takes up the role of Isaiah's suffering servant. We talked about this a little bit last week, and we're going through Isaiah on Wednesday nights, and so maybe I just have Isaiah on the brain. But Isaiah predicted the coming of the snake crusher who was going to do away with Ra once and for all. And he makes this prediction in a set of poems or songs about the servant, this figure he calls the servant. We call him the suffering servant. One of them would be Isaiah 53. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was wounded for our iniquities. And Jesus takes up the role of this servant who should have been Israel. Isaiah, I think, is written that... how do I say what I'm trying to say? The songs in Isaiah are originally meant to be about Israel, but Israel squanders it. And so Jesus becomes for Israel what they have failed to be, which goes back to number one. And then Jesus refers to himself as the Son of Man, which, if you guys remember the series we did in Daniel last year, in chapter 7, Daniel has this dream of four great beasts rising up out of the earth. And these are the four great kingdoms of the earth, or a series of kingdoms. But their power is taken away, and then one like a Son of Man rides the clouds up to the Ancient of Days, and all of their power is given to him. And Jesus, in this figure, the Son of Man, Jesus calls himself the Son of Man. Actually, I don't know that Jesus ever calls himself Christ. He doesn't deny it when people call him that, but his preferred term for himself is the Daniel 7 Son of Man, the one who receives the power of the beasts. So I've spent too long on this first slide already, but the point is that the New Testament books are making the claim that Jesus is this anticipated figure who's going to crush Ra. And of course, that happens nowhere more clearly or more importantly than in the cross. So before we talk about the cross, thoughts, questions, rude remarks, insults, Rotten Tomatoes. All right, let's talk about the cross. We should not imagine that God deals with personal sin and guilt through the cross, but the existence of evil, that needs to be explained or fixed in some other way. For example, philosophy, or what I'm really thinking about is philosophy. The cross is God's response to the existence of evil. The solution to evil is not an explanation. You guys have seen on the news what happened in Turkey this week. What is needed is not an explanation, because explanations will bring no comfort. The solution to evil, God's solution to evil, is the cross. The cross is not just how God deals with our spiritual rap sheet. It does do that, but that is not all the cross does. Individual salvation is a tile in a mosaic of what God is doing. And the cross is at the center of the whole thing. So what is God doing about evil in the death and resurrection of Jesus? And I got to slow down. First of all, God becomes the victim of evil at its darkest and its most saturated. Evil at its most dense. God becomes the victim of it. He becomes the victim of political evil, corporate evil, humans banding together. You know, there's something about when humans work together to do evil. It magnifies. It's not like my evil plus your evil equals two evils. It's like my evil plus your evil equals exponential evil. Rome and the Jewish authorities killed Jesus. But why did they kill him? What was Rome's motivation for killing Jesus?
To pacify the natives.
Pacify the natives.
He was a threat.
He was a threat?
Yeah.
Let me put it this way. Whenever somebody was crucified, they always would have a sign indicating what crime they were being killed for. And what crime is on Jesus' sign? That he's the king of the Jews.
But that was a swipe at the Jews themselves.
It is.
When Pilate put that up, he was insulting the Jews.
Yep. So political, corporate corruption. Jesus is crucified. And who is he crucified between?
Two thieves.
Okay, don't think like cat burglars who broke into someone's house. That's not what they are. These are, I think the better word is insurrectionists. They're freedom fighters. They're Jewish rebels who are trying to throw off Rome. When Pilate makes the offer, you have Jesus over here, and you have the other guy's name is actually also Jesus. Jesus Barabbas. But he gives them these two options. And why is Barabbas in jail? Do you remember? Because he had committed murder during an insurrection. These are the kinds of people who get crucified. And Jesus takes the place of an insurrectionist. There are many things that the political powers and the corporate powers may do that are raw. But the quintessential expression of corporate evil is murder. Inflicting death on another. There is no political sin before or since that was darker or deeper than the execution of Jesus in order to protect their own power.
For Pilate, it was a career move, because he didn't want complaints coming back to Caesar and jeopardize his career.
Yeah, Pilate already didn't have a great assignment. He is in a backwater district. He's been appointed to be governor of Alaska or something. I'm just trying to think of like the most remote. The whole time he's been there, he's had to deal with little uprisings and mobs and so on. We have records of these. The one that seems to be kind of brewing around Jesus, that would have been like number 5 or 6 in his few years there. So Pilate is constantly having to put down things like this. And I'm sure Larry's right. He probably does not want to go back to Rome, although maybe he does want to go back to Rome because he prefers Rome to Alaska. I don't know. What is God doing about evil? Oh, Israel's own corruption. God becomes the victim of Israel's own violence. Jesus was killed because Israel has become just as corrupt and power hungry as all the other nations. You remember, this nation once asked for a king. Why did they want a king? So that we might be like all the other nations. And now the nation that wanted a king so they could be like all other nations is reduced to saying, we have no king but Caesar. Israel rejects their God many times in the biblical story. Would you agree? The Old Testament is the story of Israel rejecting God over and over and over. Just read the book of Judges over and over and over and over. And in the cross, they don't just reject him. They string him up on a pole and kill him. God becomes the victim of Ra at its darkest and its most saturated. And then supernatural evil. The cross is the culmination of Jesus' battle with supernatural evil, with demonic power, with the Satan, with the power of evil itself. Think about a time that you have suffered. And not petty suffering. Think about a time of real loss, real heartache. Were you the victim of Ra? Ra comes from, another one bites the dust. Ra has come again. Yeah? Is that what happened? Death came into your household and took from you? Anti-life, anti-flourishing came into your house? So what was it that brought healing or hope or redemption, life, peace, and order? It's a real question, not a rhetorical question.
You're talking about Jesus coming. You're talking about the resurrection. Is that too soon?
Yes. Yeah, we're not to the resurrection yet.
But still a new way of thinking came.
A new way of thinking.
If we didn't have God and Jesus in our individual lives, we couldn't go on. The Word.
The Word?
What brought comfort? The Word. Psalms.
Any psalms in particular?
Oh, there's several.
Any kind of psalm in particular?
The psalms where it talks about, I've been come against the and God of salvation, that that there is, he is there, even though it's bad, I guess is what I would say.
So maybe psalms of lament, psalms like, God, I sure need your help.
Yeah.
I think I've told this story before, but it's one of those core formative moments for me, so I'm sure I'll tell it again. When I was a senior in high school, my father passed away, and I had all kinds of people come up and say, God, you know, God was ready for him to be in heaven, or we're really thankful for his life, or so sorry. the things that you say to people. And none of it brought any kind of comfort or any kind of healing, hope, redemption, life. And I found myself at a church service where a friend of mine went to church. I was sitting on the back row. I mean, they only probably had 50 seats. I mean, it was tight. It was long and narrow. They were renting some sort of warehouse space. But I was sitting on the back row, and I wasn't singing. I couldn't bring myself to sing. I don't even remember why I was there. But after the sermon, they had the invitation, and I just came up and sat on the front row. And I didn't want to talk to anybody, because what do you say? Just, I hurt. And a friend of mine, who was also there, who I didn't know went to that church, and was older than me by probably 10 or 15 years, she came up and sat down next to me, and she put her arm around me and said, "I lost my dad too." And for the first time, I felt some kind of relief. God becomes the victim of evil. And I think that that is, in some way, what he is doing about evil. Solidarity is the beginning of healing. That he was numbered among the transgressors. And if God is going to do anything about evil in any meaningful way, apparently it has to begin with solidarity. We don't have a high priest who is unfamiliar with our suffering. What is God doing about evil? He is absorbing the consequences of evil. Death is the final and ultimate consequence of Ra. It is the last great enemy. God absorbs the consequences. It's not like God is just going to turn back the timetables and pretend like evil never existed. There has to be consequences for God to be just, for the world to be just in the end. But God absorbs these consequences into himself. And then resurrection. God begins a new creation through the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. Which he's been working on this, trying to get this thing fired up from the beginning. And in the resurrection of Jesus, it finally turns over. In John's gospel, after the resurrection, you remember Mary goes to the tomb and he's not there. Actually, several women go to the tomb and he's not there. And then some of the women leave to go tell the men. But Mary stays behind. And she has this encounter with Jesus. You have a man and a woman in a garden. She takes him to be a gardener before she recognizes him. What day of the week is it? It's the first day of the week, Sunday. So it's like the 7 days of creation are behind us, and it is the first day of a new creation. And in this garden, there is no snake. You have this new Adam, and I'm not saying, I know there's like this conspiracy theory about Jesus and Mary. I'm not trying to make that point. I'm just saying you have a man and you have a woman in a garden. Don't miss the imagery. And there is no snake in this garden. There is no test in this garden. There is only faith and joy and a reverent and holy and awesome fear. There's belief. There's trust. It's the first day of a new creation. One of the tools that's been helpful for me in this whole series is a book by N.T. Wright called Evil and the Justice of God. And here's what he says in this book. What, after all, would it look like if the true God were to come and deal with evil? When the true God comes back to deal with evil, he will look like a young Jewish prophet journeying to Jerusalem at Passover time, celebrating the kingdom, confronting the corrupt authorities, feasting with friends, succumbing in prayer and agony to a cruel and unjust fate, taking upon himself the weight of Israel's sin, the world's sin, evil with a capital E. I don't know what you think it's going to look like when God deals with evil, if it's going to be, if he's going to come and get rid of the bad guys. But the way that he deals with it is, first and foremost, to die with us. And to die for us. To absorb the consequences of wrath into himself. Thoughts? Questions? And next week, the whole thing is, what do we do about evil? How do we live in light of the death and resurrection of Jesus? What does it mean to be kingdom people? Dealing with things like prayer and holiness and... That was the bell. But we're going to dig into it next week. What do we do about it? And then we're going to try and land the whole plane with specifically, what can you do or say when someone else is hurting? Which I think, hopefully that'll be like the biggest payoff for the whole series. What do you do in a situation like that? So, Ed, I have all the answers. So, all right, guys, I'll see you next week.